You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
6 weeks after the armistice ending World War I was signed in 1918, a contingent of more than 4,000 Canadian soldiers was mobilized for battle in a new theater of war, Siberia. This largely forgotten chapter of Canadian history is the subject of a new book by Canadian historian Benjamin Izzet. The book is called From Victoria to Vladivostok, Canada's Siberian Expedition, 1917 to 1919. Benjamin Izzet spoke about his book at Rhizome Cafe earlier this month, and we recorded the evening. We're going to bring you his talk this hour. The presentation was accompanied by a series of slides, but it's easy to follow along without the visuals. Benjamin Izzet began by thanking the people who helped him in his work on the book, and we join the talk as he introduces family members of two of the Canadians who went on the Siberian expedition.
Fred Dallin, where is Mr. Dallin? Right here. His grandfather was a Canadian captain who sailed on the first ship with Margaret Curry, who I just met tonight, and her grandfather was a sapper, so we have an officer and an enlisted man's grandchildren here today. And coincidentally, for one, Mr. Dallin and I have been corresponding for several months. But it's always special to include the families of these 4,000 forgotten war veterans because for 93 years or 91 years, their history has never been told. It existed only in word of mouth, in family folklore, when granddad or with a previous generation, when dad went to Russia. So to actually finally find it being acknowledged by the historiography of Canada, I think is an important step. And I think as the years unfold, I believe more and more information will come out, so perhaps we'll be here for a revised edition in several years as I connect with families like these ones. So here's a photograph depicting Canadian soldiers in Vladivostok, Russia, taken in 1919. And the question that comes to mind is, what were the Canadians doing in Russia? Now that's a huge question that I won't really answer today. But just to touch on some of the causes, which kind of wove together economics, military strategy, diplomacy, and also ideology, I'll just discuss them briefly. This whole topic of the Siberian Expedition forces us to shift how we think about the First World War, which is going to be commemorated this Thursday on Remembrance Day. When we think of the First World War in terms of what's going to be mainly in the media, it will talk about Vimy Ridge and the heroism of the Canadian Corps. They probably won't talk as much about the bloodbath that happened on the Western Front, where 66,000 Canadians were killed in this war of attrition. We think about Vimy Ridge, Passchendaele, the Somme. We think about November 11th, this upcoming Thursday, as having ended the war. But this Siberian expedition forces us to move our lens around the world, from the Western Front to the Pacific world and the far east of Russia. And it also forces us to move our lens time-wise beyond November 11th, because the vast majority of the 4,000 Canadians left British Columbia after the war had ended in Europe. Now, the two families here tonight happen to be in the exception. They were on the ship of about 700 troops, the advance party, that left Canada exactly 1 month before the war ended on October 11th. But the vast majority of this military experience and the lived experiences of these 4,000 troops happened after the war had ended in Europe. I traveled to Russia 2 years ago to, I guess, on my own Siberian expedition to understand this history. This is me boarding the Trans-Siberian Railroad in Vladivostok, because to understand events in Russia after the revolution, we have to look at events in European Russia. And so I took the train across the country to understand this history. Today is November the 7th, and 93 years ago was an extremely influential date in the history of the world. That was the day that the Bolshevik Party, led by Vladimir Lenin, seized control of the Russian state. 6 months earlier, one of the oldest monarchies in Europe, the Romanov monarchy, had been toppled in about a week of demonstrations, initially led by women textile workers in the capital Petrograd, joined by metal trades workers, and eventually by the local military garrison. So in just one short week, the Romanov monarchy was no more. And 6 months later, the Bolshevik Party, this radical socialist party, seized control of Russia and basically became the most radical government in the world at that time. The Bolsheviks began to implement a very far-reaching agenda of economic and political and social reform. Things like abortion were legalized for the first time in the world by that regime. Daycare was brought in as well. There were also other changes, the nationalization of private land, the nationalization of factories, the nationalization of private wealth. And militarily, the Bolsheviks signed a peace deal with Germany that removed their country from the war. So initially, they had invited all the countries that were at war to negotiate a peace deal. Germany was the only country that took the Bolsheviks up on the offer. And so the Bolsheviks signed a separate peace deal that made the country a de facto enemy of Canada and all the other allies. So over the course of 1917, Russia went from being a close ally of Canada to being an enemy. And that turns us to the Russian Far East. While Russia was still allied with Canada, a huge amount of war supplies had been shipped from Burrard Inlet to the Russian Far East. Railroad wheels like these ones, manufactured by Canadian workers in Canadian factories, shipped to the Far East of Russia to aid the Tsar's armies. Ammunition like these ones. There was something like 700,000 tons of ammunition in the port of Vladivostok when the Bolsheviks took power. Locally, there was a local equivalent of the revolution. And this university student, a 24-year-old student named Konstantin Sukhanov, became the local leader of the Soviet. He had been a university student in Petrograd, where he had joined the Bolshevik Party. When he returned to Vladivostok, he began organizing local shipyard workers. And 1 month after the Bolsheviks took power in the capital, he was elected president of the Vladivostok Soviet. And so you had this 24-year-old student being the de facto leader of Russia's Far Eastern port. This is what Vladivostok looked like in 1918, at the moment Sukhanov took power. It was the most influential port on the Pacific, the terminus of the world's longest railroad, and the headquarters of the Russian Pacific Naval Fleet. And this unstable situation developed. Sukhanov, with his local Bolshevik party and the local Soviet, the Workers' Council, was administering the city around the harbor. And yet within the harbor itself, a whole succession of foreign warships arrived and began to drop anchor. Initially, Japanese warships, followed by a British warship, followed by an American warship. And so you had this situation of dual power. Foreign warships at anchor in the harbor and a Bolshevik administration running the city around the harbor. And the situation could hardly last. At the end of June 1918, a coup took place that toppled Sukhanov's Soviet government. It was spearheaded by this very anomalous military force, which Alan alluded to, the Czechoslovak Legion, which has been described as the army without a country. There were about 13,000 of them in Vladivostok. The circumstances are too detailed to go into, but basically they had been stranded in the middle of Siberia. They got in a fight in a random railroad station and ended up seizing control of the Trans-Siberian Railroad for about 7,000 kilometers of its 8,600-kilometer length. So you had a foreign army that controlled the lifeline connecting Vladivostok to the interior of Russia. And all of a sudden, a foreign intervention seemed to be possible. So these Czechoslovaks, joined with Marines from the British and French and American ships, as well as a group of Chinese troops who crossed over from Manchuria, toppled the Sukhanov government. This is a funeral depicting, this is a photograph depicting the funeral for about 50 longshore workers, Grushki, who were killed defending the Soviet headquarters. It was described by an American journalist as the Red Funeral of Vladivostok, and an estimated 17,000 local residents attended the funeral. Political power passed into the hands of this man, the White Russian governor of the Far East, General Dmitry Horvat, who had been the manager of the Chinese Eastern Railroad that passed through Manchuria. Throughout the summer of 1918, tens of thousands of foreign troops converged on the city, including these American soldiers depicted marching down Svetlanskaya, the main street in Vladivostok. 12,000 Americans landed in Vladivostok that summer. They were joined by 77,000 Japanese troops. Japan had been untouched by the fighting of the First World War, and it was only a day and a half by sea from Vladivostok. So Japan was the largest foreign army in the region, and the whole operation was under a Japanese general. So this was the context in which Canada decided to send troops to Vladivostok. The decision was taken officially by the Privy Council in Ottawa, but really it reflected discussions happening in London in a body known as the Imperial War Cabinet, which consisted of our Prime Minister, Sir Robert Borden, a young Sir Winston Churchill, who was a cabinet minister in Britain at the time, as well as political and military leaders from throughout the British Empire. So Canada decided to send a force of 4,000 troops to Russia. In total, actually, Canada decided to send more than 5,000 troops. 4,000 of them went to Vladivostok. In total, there were these four different fronts where Canada intervened in the Russian Civil War. 600 landed at the port of Murmansk in what was called the Siren Party. And another 500 landed at the port of Arkhangelsk, also in the northwest of Russia. 41 Canadians traveled overland from Baghdad in a force known as the Dunster Force, named after the British general, and they traveled to Baku in present-day Azerbaijan to occupy the oil fields of the Caspian Sea. But the most important Canadian role in the Russian Civil War was the 4,200 troops who landed at the port of Vladivostok in the Siberian Expeditionary Force. And the size of Canada's intervention there reflected the relative proximity across the Pacific Ocean from Vancouver and Victoria to Vladivostok, which was about a 2.5-week voyage by sea. And so Canada was selected to lead the British Empire's military role in the Far East of Russia. So throughout the fall of 1918, Canadian soldiers were mobilized from every province. And this coincided with the very end of the First World War and the most brutal fighting of the First World War. In September 1918, 3,000 Canadians died in the trenches of the Western Front. And the very next month, another 3,000 Canadians died. So this was the most bloody fighting, and the Canadian government had a very difficult time raising troops for this whole new army going to a whole new theater of war. And the tensions that emerged we'll see in just a few minutes. This is a photograph or a charcoal drawing showing machine gun soldiers leaving Camp Petawawa in Ontario. And here's a photograph showing Quebecois conscripts who were mobilized from the districts around Quebec City, including a town called Saint-Epiphaine in rural Quebec. And some of the men depicted in the top of this photo would later lead a mutiny when the soldiers were marching to the wharf in Victoria. The soldiers traveled across the country along the Canadian Pacific Railroad. And an interesting side note to this story, which touches on medical history, was that the Spanish flu, the great influenza epidemic of 1918, first reached Western Canada aboard these ships. The first cases of influenza in Winnipeg and Calgary and here in Vancouver were detected within hours of these Siberia-bound troop trains passing through the towns. So the Canadians mobilized to the West Coast. Some were quartered here in New Westminster at the Queen's Park Barracks. Others were quartered under canvas in Coquitlam. But most of the soldiers were quartered in Victoria at the Willows Camp. In peacetime, it was in the exhibition grounds where horse racing and other events took place. In wartime, it was a military base. It's located in the municipality of Oak Bay, about 1 kilometer south of the University of Victoria campus. So the date of this photograph is significant, November 1918, because that was the date that the war ended in Europe. And the armistice that ended the fighting in Europe created a huge debate over whether the Siberian expedition should even go to Russia. And this debate extended all the way from the cabinet of Robert Borden down through the business community with important newspapers like the Globe in Toronto running editorials against the expedition. And the opposition extended all the way through the ranks of farmers, of workers with the Labour Council here in Vancouver, as well as most other cities, passing resolutions against the expedition. And the opposition extended all the way down to the soldiers themselves. And in the streets of Victoria, the soldiers entered into a very unique dialogue with activists from the local labor movement and from local organizations like the Socialist Party of Canada. And the labor movement began to organize meetings like this one, attended by literally hundreds of members of the force. At this meeting in December of 1918, an estimated 700 soldiers of the 3,000 who were mobilized to Victoria attended a meeting organized under the slogan, Hands Off Russia. A member of the provincial legislature spoke out against the expedition, and a number of other speakers did as well. So the product of this unique dialogue between the Quebecois conscripts and the British Columbia socialists was a mutiny in the streets of Victoria the day the soldiers were marching to the wharf. They had left the Willows camp at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and when they were halfway along the march to the wharf, a group of French Canadians near the back of the march refused to continue marching, or refused to resume marching. They had actually stopped for a 10-minute break. The commanding officer blew his whistle and ordered them to fall in. And one of the French Canadians shouted, "On y va pas, en Siberia." We won't go to Siberia. Another shouted in English, "Outwards turn," suggesting that the troops turn around and head back to the camp. And so the commanding officer fired his gun over their heads and near their feet, and still they refused to march. And so the commanding officer ordered the obedient troops to take off their belts. And then he ordered the obedient men to whip the mutinous soldiers back into line. It took about 10 minutes, and then a guard of honor formed, which was 50 soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder with rifles and fixed bayonets. And that appears to have been enough to convince the mutinous troops to resume the march. And so at the point of the bayonet, the 259th Battalion proceeded down to the outer wharf. It took 21 hours to get them onto this ship, the SS Tista. A dozen ringleaders were shackled together in the bottom of the ship. They weren't allowed to shower or bathe for 37 days at the height of the Spanish flu until they were court-martialed in Vladivostok. And they later received sentences ranging from 3 months hard labor to 3 years hard labor. The sentences were actually suspended before they came back to Canada when members of Parliament from Quebec began to ask questions over the legality of sending these conscripts to Russia, since the operation didn't seem to fall within the defense of the realm, which was the language of the Military Service Act. So aboard this ship and another ship that sailed from Victoria 5 days later, the Canadian Siberian Expeditionary Force, or the main body of it, reached Vladivostok. This is a painting drawn by a Canadian war artist depicting Chinese soldiers unloading the ship. And here you can see Canadian soldiers marching down Svetlanskaya, the main street in Vladivostok. This is a map drawn by a Canadian cartographer in 1918. And at the center of the photograph, or of the map, is this building, the Pushkin Theater, named after the famous Russian poet. And this building served as the Canadian force headquarters. When the Canadian general seized the building, he angered the local businessmen who operated a theater and library in this building. So even the local bourgeoisie, which should have been naturally supportive of the Allied intervention, was antagonized by the Canadians from the outset. This is what the Pushkin Theater looks like today. And this is what Vladivostok looks like today. It's still an active harbor, a very hilly place with a funicular railroad that climbs up a hillside very close to the Canadian headquarters, which is actually located immediately adjacent to the lower funicular railroad station. This is a very complicated map of Russia, but I won't go into the details. But all I'm going to mention is the difficulties behind this strategy. And it helps us to understand why the Siberian expedition was a colossal failure. The strategy was something akin, well, the idea was that the troops would land here at Vladivostok to fight a war that was raging 7,000 kilometers to the west in the Ural Mountains, which divide Asia from Europe. It was a strategy akin to landing soldiers at Halifax to fight a war in the coast mountains of BC. And in fact, a further distance. It would be something like a few hundred kilometers off the coast of Vancouver Island. North America at the time had 5 intercontinental railroads, or around that number. Russia and Asia only had 1 railroad, the Trans-Siberian. And right at the moment the Canadians arrived, that railroad was paralyzed. And there were 2 main factors. One was a huge amount of divisions between the Allies, between the Japanese, the Americans, as well as the White Russian groups. And there was also a homegrown guerrilla movement called the Partisan Movement, which emerged around this time. And the Partisans began to blow up the railroad. They oppose the White Russians, and they oppose the Allies as well. So this is a photograph taken by a Canadian soldier in the interior of Russia depicting a railroad bridge blown up. Literally dozens of acts of sabotage like this occurred right at the moment the Canadians reached Russia. And so in the face of this partisan insurgency, the Canadian government made perhaps the sound decision, decided the soldiers would not proceed into the interior, at least the main body of them. A handful had already gone inland. And the government also decided to cancel the mission entirely. But it took several months to find ships to bring them home. This is a photograph depicting that small group, the advance party of 55 Canadians that traveled to the interior, 6,000 kilometers to the city of Omsk, which was the capital of the White Russian movement and the government of Admiral Alexander Kolchak, who had been a naval commander for the Tsar. There was only one operation that even resembled combat, and we're going to watch a short video that highlights the situation facing the Canadians. It was the short-lived deployment of 1,000 soldiers to the town of Shkodovo, about 50 kilometers north of Vladivostok. 200 Canadians joined this multinational force that was led by a Japanese commander and included Japanese, Italian, French, Czech, and Chinese troops. So if the technology cooperates, we're going to watch a video. Otherwise, I'll just explain.
It's interesting being in Shkodovo, and this was a very historic site because it's a key railway access point between the Sichuan coal mines and Vladivostok. And the partisans in 1919 were attempting to cut off the coal supply to Vladivostok, so the Canadians, under a Japanese commander and joined by Italian troops, came to Shkodovo to repel a Bolshevik advance. When they showed up here, the Bolsheviks and the partisans were gone. So the Canadians returned to Vladivostok, where they were awarded with about 100 cases of sake. But interestingly enough, in this bizarre Siberian expedition, that's as close as the Canadians got to active engagement against the enemy.
One thing that is interesting about Shkodovo was a direct connection between conscripts like this man, Rifleman Sidney Roger, and the enemy, the partisan insurgents. And Sid Roger wrote in his diary, I was loaned the diary by the family a few years ago, he wrote verbatim the text of a proclamation or a communique issued by the enemy at the height of this Shkodovo operation. And the text is also preserved in the National Archives in Ottawa. It was signed by this man, a farmer from the region outside Vladivostok named Gavrila Shevchenko. He was the commander of the partisans. And the tone of Shevchenko's proclamation, I think, indicates the strength of the partisan movement and the very weak position of the Allies. And it helps us to understand why Canada evacuated its forces around this time. And I'll just read it out. "We demand that you evacuate our territory and go back from where you came. If you will not submit to this order, we will not give you one inch of the railway, which we have built with our very blood. Remember that in this we are not alone, but the working classes of the whole world are with us." And so the partisans drew a very direct connection between their struggle against the whites and the Allies in the far east of Russia, and the struggle of workers everywhere. Around this time, the Canadian equipment garage in Vladivostok burnt to the ground, destroying 16 trucks that had been transported from British Columbia to the far east of Russia. So it took, as I mentioned, a few months to find ships to bring the Canadians home. So what did the Canadians do in Vladivostok? Well, it's interesting because many soldiers' memories are marked by horror, seeing a comrade die in the trench or killing someone in cold blood, sometimes brutally. But the Canadians, most of them didn't have these experiences. And as the director of the museum in Vladivostok put it in a conversation with me last year, there were 4,000 Canadian tourists in Russia during one of the darkest chapters in the city's history. And so these Canadians in Vladivostok basically did nothing in Vladivostok. They did some patrols, they did routine drill activities, they guarded different barracks and warehouses, but most of their memories are colored by recreational pursuits. Two brigade newspapers were printed. Mrs. Curry's grandfather was in the unit that published this paper, and she actually has far more copies than are preserved in the Canadian archives. The title, or the headline, depicts something that was on the minds of many of the troops. What are we doing here? The Canadians played a lot of sporting activities. They organized a baseball league like this one, soccer leagues, hockey leagues. Boxing matches took place nightly in the barracks. They organized a large sports day for the various Allied contingents called a Gymkhana that took place on International Labor Day, the 1st of May, 1919. They were quartered principally at these barracks at a place called Gornostai Bay, about 15 kilometers east of the city. That's what Gornostai Bay looked like back then, and this is what Gornostai Bay looks like today. About 15 years ago, after the end of the Cold War, these buildings were transferred from the Russian military to civilian authorities, and today they provide housing for local civilians, including this woman who lives in a barrack building formerly occupied by the Canadian troops. And this building next door serves as the local post office, which Mike, a postal worker, will find interesting. Across Vladivostok was this barrack complex called Second River. There was accommodations for roughly 100,000 troops. The Tsar had built all these barracks just in the decade leading up to the revolution to guard against the Japanese attack. It turns out he was quite right because the Japanese arrived and ended up using the buildings for their own barracks and those of their allies. Mainly, the Mounties were quartered in these barracks. There were 200 members of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police quartered in Vladivostok. And this is what the Second River Barracks look like today. This part of Vladivostok has extended into the area, so the old Tsarist-era barracks are now surrounded by modern apartment towers. The officers would ride into Vladivostok on these horse-drawn carts called droshky. And I guess Mr. Dallin's grandfather probably rode this way. The lower ranks, so Ms. Curry's grandfather would ride into Vladivostok on tram or by foot. And at some point, though, the Canadian general banned travel on the trams as a typhus epidemic spread through the city. There was one woman in Canada's Siberian Expeditionary Force. Nursing matron Grace Aldrida Potter was served with the Canadian Red Cross mission in the city. Before she left Vladivostok, she went on a highly publicized tour of before she left Vancouver, she went on a highly publicized tour of Vancouver's textile district, buying socks and underwear and clothing and shoes for Russian children. So that humanitarian motive that Professor Seeger mentioned was advertised prominently in the Vancouver press. The Canadians seem to focus on the exotic and the other. I guess we could use what scholars would call Orientalism to understand how the Canadians viewed the local population. At the time, one-third of Vladivostok residents were Asian, either Korean or Chinese by ethnicity. And so the Canadians focused disproportionately on things like this exotic bear show or on these Korean fishermen who occupied a village or lived in a village on Gornostai Bay, very close to their own barracks. The sex trade was alive and well in occupied Vladivostok, as it is in all theaters of war. And here's a Canadian soldier, a mounted police officer, standing with a group of Russian prostitutes. There was an interesting distinction between the policy of the Japanese and the Canadians. The Japanese had a regulated form of prostitution. Sex trade workers had come to Vladivostok with the expeditionary force. There were regular medical inspections, and the soldiers had ration cards for comfort visits. In contrast, the Canadian policy was one of abstinence. This reflected the idea that sexual relations would never happen outside of wedlock. But perhaps showing the realism of the Japanese position, up to roughly one half of all the hospital beds in the Canadian hospital at Second River were occupied by cases relating to venereal disease. So I think we find that sexual relations are an essential component of every military conflict. There was a huge amount of human suffering in occupied Vladivostok, and literally tens of thousands of refugees had ridden the railroad as far as they could, reaching the terminal city of Vladivostok. And when they got there, they had nowhere to live. So literally thousands of them squatted this building, the railroad station, vacant stairwells, any vacant piece of floor space, or the boxcars and passenger cars on the tracks leading into the town. And there was a huge amount of death. People were starving. They didn't have food, and there was disease breaking out everywhere. the Canadians would find a morbid sense of entertainment visiting a place called the morgue. It was kind of like how they would visit a local cinema. They would go up to this dilapidated building on a hill and take photos of the dead bodies. And that, I think that shows maybe the otherworldly character of Vladivostok at the time, that they would find fascination in this. You can find references to the morgue in their diaries and a number of photos in the albums the soldiers took home. So that's a photograph taken by Canadian troops in the morgue. So the Canadians evacuated Vladivostok on four ships between April and June 1919. And before leaving, they commemorated this burial plot because 14 Canadians did not return from Vladivostok. Most of them died of disease, two died of accidents, and one soldier, the only officer to die, an insurance clerk from Montreal named Alfred Thring, took his own life at the Canadian barracks outside of Gornistai Bay. Another soldier who died was this man, Edwin Stevenson. And in peacetime, Edwin Stevenson had been an Anglican priest, but he enlisted in the Canadian Army the day after he was ordained in 1918. He joined as a non-combatant soldier, as a medic, with the Canadian Army Medical Corps. He traveled up country to Omsk. He was recalled to Vladivostok as the troops prepared to evacuate. He contracted smallpox, and he died at the Canadian hospital at Second River about 10 days before he was scheduled to sail home. And this is what Edwin Stevenson's grave looks like today. In the 1990s, after the end of the Cold War, Vladivostok was once again opened up to foreigners. During the Cold War, it had been, quote, a closed city. It was the headquarters of the Soviet nuclear submarine fleet on the Pacific. And so many Russians, and certainly no foreigners, could visit the city. Well, in the 1990s, a naval ship traveled from Esquimalt in Victoria to Vladivostok with headstones that had been carved in Victoria. And they restored the site along the lines, the standard look of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. This is what the Canadian monument looks like today. This was carved by a Czechoslovak soldier. So we're going to watch a final video.
Hello, I am Dr. Benjamin Isett, and I'm standing here today on Wednesday, March 26, 2008, at the Cherkin Russian Naval Cemetery, outside of Vladivostok, Russia. I'm standing here alongside the graves of 14 Canadians and 14 British soldiers who were buried here 90 years ago. These Canadians and British soldiers are buried alongside Czechoslovaks at the back of the cemetery, and also a mass grave of Japanese. There's also French and American soldiers buried in this common site. And you can see here, this is the monument to the Canadian and British dead. And further back is the monument to the Czechoslovaks, and there's also a monument to the Japanese. And if we walk over this way, Sergei Ivanov, my interpreter, will kindly help demonstrate. This monument here commemorates the Canadian and British soldiers who didn't get buried in Vladivostok. They either died at sea or died further afield, upcountry in the Russian Far East. And you can see here at the bottom, it lists the three Canadians who were buried elsewhere in Russia or at sea. So as we stand here today, in this spring day in Vladivostok, it's important to remember the Canadian dead and also to question why they were sent here to fight.
So these Canadians weren't remembered. Ms. Dallin's grandfather, Mr. Dallin's grandfather, Ms. Curry's grandfather, and the families of another 4,206 soldiers were forgotten. And the fear of this history being forgotten was on the minds of many labor activists here in Vancouver, including the author of this editorial entitled Lessons to be Learned, published in October 1919, just a few months after the soldiers had returned home in the wake of general strikes that paralyzed cities from Vancouver to Winnipeg to Amherst in Nova Scotia. And so I'll read it out. When the true history of the machinations of the Allied countries and their efforts to overthrow the Soviet regime is written, it will disclose such an amazing story of intrigue and duplicity as to make honest people shudder. Not half of the story has been told and never will be told if the ruling class of the Allied nations can prevent it. But they will not be able to cover up the tracks. The workers of the world are moving forward, and it will be the function of that class to uncover how secret diplomacy has functioned against the new democracy. And as Alan mentioned in his introduction, it was a party of the working class that was the first to write a book called Lenin in Canada, or another book called Canada and the Russian Revolution. Mainstream academia and Canadian historians largely ignored this topic for 91 years. So this book is the first study that focuses on Canada's Siberian expedition. There were a handful of journal articles before it, a handful of two books that looked at the overall contours of Canada's role in the Russian Civil War that devoted chapters to Siberia. But this is the first book to look in detail at the story of the troops themselves. So I'm just going to conclude with a reading from the book. The Canadian Expeditionary Force Siberia, born out of the chaotic social pressures of the First World War and the Russian Revolution, was too complex a story to be told in tandem with the image of valor being constructed around the Canadian Corps at Vimy Ridge. From Victoria to Vladivostok, the Canadian government had engaged in a battle against labor radicalism, Bolshevism in the lexicon of the day, a failed attempt to alter the outcome of the Russian Revolution and to install a more sympathetic government in Russia. In the unstable climate following the war in Europe, geopolitical patterns were contested in Siberia and in the streets of Victoria. Decades before the Cold War, the battle lines were drawn. The seething tensions and ambitions surrounding the Siberian expedition among Anglophone and Francophone workers and farmers, Siberian peasants and partisans, white soldiers and motley foreign troops, and Canadian financiers in the state exposed the class basis of Canadian foreign policy. Canada lost in Siberia, its first foray as a world power, and then quietly ignored this history. So on this 93rd anniversary of the Russian Revolution, I thank you all for coming here tonight and allowing me to share this forgotten chapter in the history of British Columbia, Russia, Canada, Asia, and the world. And as we move into Remembrance Week, I think it's really important for us to remember these forgotten war veterans and their experiences. So thank you very much.